And thank you, Jay, for that whirlwind. I'm going to take us not quite so broadly. What I want to do with this presentation is really talk about is use mammography guidelines and the kerfuffle, which seems to be the word of the meeting for me in a few sessions I've been in, around mammography guidelines as an example of the role that the media can play and social media play and how people make decisions and talk about these decisions. I think that just as Jay highlighted that people don't make their medical and health decisions in a vacuum, we've always known that, but that there are many more ways in which people can be not just getting this information but also having conversations about the decisions that they're making and that they can be influenced by. So what I'm going to do when I talk about this is I'm going to give a little bit of background about breast cancer because this is not a breast cancer specific session, so some of you may know this and some of you may not. But about 230,000 women will be diagnosed with invasive breast cancer in the United States this year. About 60,000 more women will have a diagnosis of DCIS, which is ductal carcinoma in situ. There's actually a big discussion going on right now because that is considered stage zero or non-invasive disease. So for other cancers, when we talk about stage zero, we don't call it cancer. And so there's a big discussion right now about whether or not DCIS should even be called cancer because the five-year survival rate is over 99% for women who have DCIS. So keep this in mind when we start to talk about mammography guidelines. And about a fifth to a third of these women would likely progress to some sort of invasive disease, but that means the vast majority of them would never have invasive disease, meaning disease that has the capability to spread beyond the breast. Having said that, about 40,000 women will die of breast cancer this year. It's the second leading cause of cancer death for women, and because we've been very, very successful with campaigns around mammography and breast cancer awareness, people are very scared and in some cases overly scared of their risks of breast cancer and their risks of dying of breast cancer. However, most women who are diagnosed have no family history of breast cancer. So when we set the stage for screening in populations, why screening is important, you can start to understand where this all fits in. So the issue at hand is that in 2009, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force produced updated guidelines around screening mammography. The major changes were that they said screen from their older guidelines, and I'll show a table in a minute. Screening is not recommended until age 50. Screening should be every 2 years instead of annually. And the decision to start screening mammography before age 50 should be an individual one with the patient context taken into account, including the patient's values regarding specific benefits and harms. So the sidebar here, which is what is shared decision-making, and this ties in very well with Jay's presentation about participatory medicine. For those of you who don't work in the realm of shared decision-making, you may have heard this phrase. I argue that it's actually outside of the research world. It's very poorly understood. It's poorly understood by clinicians. But generally what it means, and I'm using Wikipedia as where I'm getting this definition from, but it's one that I mostly agree with. The emphasis is added. It's an approach where clinicians and patients communicate together using the best available evidence when faced with the task of making decisions, particularly where patients are supported to deliberate about the possible attributes and consequences of options, to arrive at informed preferences and making a determination about the best action and which respects patient autonomy. So in short, this is something where patient values and preferences are really paramount in what happens. So you might even have a situation where you have the clinically best decision, and yet that's a decision that is not acceptable to the patient for a variety of reasons. So it's not just where you say, well, we don't really know what the best thing is. It's we don't know what the best thing is for you, so you, patient, need to help us figure that out, and we need to do this together. So now when I talk about that, I'm going to say that this is one other model, but you can think about it as information sharing from patients to providers and back from providers to patients, as well as a decision-making process where there's discussion, there's deliberation, there's making sure everybody understands one another, as well as something that you could call decision finalization. So, you know, what people think of when they think of decision making is I have now made a decision. But when people who talk about shared decision making talk about it, they're talking about this entirety of the process, not just what that final decision is. And what's important here, especially when you start to talk about things like media and social media and people making decisions, is that it doesn't all happen in the doctor's office, right? And so when they're making those decisions, they can say, or somebody can say, or I can observe that and say that the decision was made here. But there's also this follow-up, which is, am I making this decision? Have I really bought into it in my own head in the doctor's office? Or is there other stuff that's going on? Do I arrange for follow-up? Do I decide that I'm going to go on the internet when I leave the doctor's office? Do I call my spouse? What do I do with that? So that's actually all also part of the decision-making process. And I'll come back to that in a minute. So coming back to what I talked about with the U.S. Services Preventive Task Force guidelines, if you look on the left, their original guidelines, well, not original, but their 2002 guidelines said that you should begin mammograms at 40. So you can see that the second column is the new guidelines that I already mentioned. So instead of annually, every 2 years, there's also no recommended age to stop screening, which they changed to saying that there was insufficient evidence to assess benefits and harms of screening in women aged over 75. Clinical breast exam, that wasn't really a change, and self-breast exam, there wasn't really a big change. Now, if you compare this, so beginning at age 50, the 2009 update, beginning at age 50, every 2 years, you should probably stop around age 75, no evidence for clinical breast exams and recommending against self-breast exams. Now you go to the NCI recommendations and the American Cancer Society recommendations. Both of these say that you should have, and they currently say that you should have screening at age 40. American Cancer Society says annually instead of, and NCI says every 1 to 2 years. No recommended age to stop screening. And they recommend a clinical breast exam in conjunction with mammography. So what you have here is a situation where not everybody's in complete agreement, and you have a lot of women who hear this and think that something is being taken away from them. This also, you may or may not remember, happened at the same time that there was debate about the Affordable Care Act. So these recommendations happened to come out during that time. They are entirely separate processes. But people took this to mean that there was rationing of care and that women, because of the Affordable Care Act, were being rationed out of having mammograms that they thought were saving lives. So why is this even a contentious issue? Why is it that you can have people who care about the public's health, who would look at this and see the evidence differently? And this is something that we have to think about anytime we start to talk about shared decision-making as well as evidence-based medicine. So the issue is really, there's two main issues. This first one is about breast density and mammography. The first is that high breast tissue density is an independent risk factor for developing breast cancer. How do you know if you have dense breasts? You don't, unless you've had a mammogram. Okay, so it's something that only that a radiologist can tell you. There's actually a great website called rudense.org where somebody who was at high risk for breast cancer because of a family history had always been getting mammograms, and then it turned out that she found out later on that the mammograms weren't doing as good a job for her as they should have because she had dense breasts. So if you have dense breasts, then sometimes it is recommended, especially if you're at high risk, to have something like a breast ultrasound instead. But that's not for everybody. But anyway. However, younger women naturally have more dense breasts than older women. On radiography, I'm not saying anything about anything else. And mammography is not as good at catching breast cancer in women with dense breasts. So because the tissue is dense, it doesn't do as good a job of highlighting something that looks suspicious. So younger women are less likely to have breast cancer than older women. They're more likely to have denser breasts, which means that they are less likely for mammography to be able to catch a cancer if it is there. Okay. And so then there's no consensus about what other testing, if any, women who have dense breasts should get. So if mammography is not as good for them, then what should you be recommending? Now we come into potential harm. Some people say, well, why do we worry about what is over-testing? Isn't information good? We all want lots of information. Well, only about 5% of women who have a suspicious mammogram will actually have cancer. So by age, women who are in their 40s are even less likely. The vast majority of those who get a biopsy will have a false positive by mammography. So the biopsy is the definitive test there. So over 10 years of screening, it's been estimated that half of women, if they are screened in their 40s every single year, half of them will end up with a false positive and 20% of them will have a biopsy. So there are real harms at a population level. And of these breast cancers found by screening, roughly half are thought to be overdiagnosis. So when they say that there's a cancer, it means a cancer like DCIS, which is not going to ever progress to an invasive cancer. Okay, so there are real potential harms here. And so when you have people say, I had breast cancer, it was caught by a screen when I was 41, mammography saved my life. That may be true, but of course at a population level, we have no way of knowing if that woman's life was actually saved. We can say out of roughly 1,000 women like her, one of those lives was saved by the screening. But we don't know if it was her or not. So do doctors know this? I know that we're going to have a talk about risk communication, so I just wanted to throw this out there. So this is a great paper from the BMJ in 2003. When data are given as conditional probabilities, this was a study that they did where they asked physicians, I think they were OBs, so these were people who would give referrals to mammograms for women. The probability that a woman has breast cancer is 0.8%. If she has breast cancer, the probability that a mammogram will show a positive test result is 90%. If she doesn't have breast cancer, the probability of a positive result is 7%. Take, for example, a woman who has a positive result. What is the probability that she actually has breast cancer? Okay, who knows? Okay. So this is how a lot of times data are given, right? Most of us in this room have read journals. We've seen information like this. Now, if you give it as natural frequencies, which is what is recommended for risk communication, if you say 8 out of every 1,000 women have breast cancer, of these 8 women, 7 will have a positive result on mammography. Okay, so you're already missing one, right? Of the 992 women who do not have breast cancer, some 70 will still have a positive mammogram. Take, for example, a sample of women who have positive mammograms. How many of them actually have breast cancer? Okay, so 70 women plus the other 7 women. So 77 women are going to have a positive mammogram, but 7 of those 77 actually have breast cancer. So this is what they found. Each dot there is a physician. So on the left, it's those who were given the conditional probabilities. And on the right, it's those who were given, which is the first way, right? So, thank you. So, and on the right, it's those who were given the natural frequencies. So the correct estimate is that line toward the bottom. So you can see on the left-hand side that lots of physicians thought that if a woman had a positive mammogram, that it was very, very likely that she had breast cancer. So the numbers there may be slightly different now, but they're not that different. So this is really important as well, because if physicians don't understand this and don't know this, and we know that physicians are the most trusted source of information, and you have women come in and say, there are these guidelines, and I don't know what I'm supposed to do. If the physicians are over in that 90% category up there with all of those red dot doctors, then this is problematic because you can't really have this idea of shared decision making unless it's really based on good evidence. So I'm not saying women shouldn't be screened, but I'm saying that if you want them to have a good discussion with their physician about whether or not those potential benefits of screening, those potential harms of screening, what risks they actually are willing to take, then they need to have a reasonable idea of what those risks are. I personally have had several clinicians say to me, oh, but we've all had women who had breast cancer at 40. You know, we've all had women, so none of those recommendations, by the way, recommend self-breast exam. I can't tell you how many clinicians have said, oh, but I've had a patient who found it doing a self-breast exam. So we can talk all we want about the evidence base, but clinicians are also people, and they have their own biases. By the way, if you're in your 40s and you go to your clinician and you say you don't want mammography, just try it just for fun, see what they say. Because that conversation doesn't usually go well. And so why don't physicians always follow clinical guidelines? So physicians may not follow guidelines for many reasons and not just with respect to breast cancer. So even if we have the guidelines and they say, yes, I want you to have let's say they follow the ACS guidelines and they say, I want you to start screening at 40 and I want you to do it every year. But they may also still recommend a self-rest exam. They may not follow the guidelines because they're not aware of them, because they're not sufficiently familiar with the details. Importantly, because they don't agree with the guidelines, because they don't think patients will follow through. They just haven't done it that way before. So clinical inertia, we need to think of clinicians as being like patients so that behavior change is hard. Clinical practice change is hard. Or that they forget or they don't have reminders. So when we talk about media and all of this, this was from 2009. Mammogram recommendations spark controversy and confusion. This was from 2010, sorting through the mammogram confusion. This was from 2012, the mammogram mess, the most difficult decision for women in their 40s. And this was just in my local paper last week, or 2 weeks ago, aware of breast cancer prevention, but confused about mammograms. So in the 4 years since those guidelines have come out, we haven't really done anything or been successful in helping women and helping clinicians through this confusion. How is it reflected in the media and on social media? There was a very nice content analysis of newspaper articles, blog posts, and tweets that found that roughly when so things were coming from sources such as newspaper articles, not in necessarily individual people, roughly half of them were unsupportive of those new U.S. Services Preventive Task Force recommendations. Their rationale was the belief that delaying screening would lead to later detection of more advanced cancers. In the public, they, as part of this study, also did a web-based survey. Women who were 40 to 49 were less likely than women 50 to 74 to identify the recommendation, where the recommendation is that you should talk with your doctor. About 30% of women did, in fact, say that this was more confusing to them and that they just didn't know what to do. And a different, as they said, about fewer than half of the women in a different study were aware of the guideline changes. And then a more recent study showed that mammography among women 40 to 49 stayed stable in 2010 compared to 2006 and 2008. So despite the fact that people are saying they're confused, we actually have not seen a drop in mammography rates among women in their 40s. So you can argue about whether or not you think that's a good thing, but there's a lot of confusion, but we're not seeing any change in rates of women being screened. So with this decision... So I showed before that decision preparation sort of model. So here, if we look at this other sort of added model, you can say that there's a decision preparation phase. We still have the information sharing, decision process, decision finalization. But then there's also this decision reflection part, where when I have these little things on the side, they say, call your mom, go to the internet, call your best friend's brother the doctor. And it's not that I think this is how decisions should best be made, but we know this is what people do, right? When was the last time any of you had a diagnosis of anything and then just went and sat home and didn't call anyone and didn't go on the internet and, yeah, you didn't call your best friend, you didn't call your spouse, you didn't tell anybody about it ever? That's not really how people make decisions, and we know this, but we haven't really figured this out in terms of decision-making models and, as Jay pointed out, also really asking people what's influential in the decisions that you make. And when we talk about people being information seekers and who's looking for that information, in my family, if I'm the patient, I'm the information seeker. If my husband's the patient, I'm still the information seeker, right? So we know that there are family dynamics at play. We know that there are relationship things at play, and we don't really address that very often when we look at people's information needs versus family information needs. So in summary, the guidelines for mammography conflict, and again, I'm just using this as an example of how we make decisions and how we talk about media and social media when we think about how people make decisions. I want to emphasize that there can be really reasonable differences of opinion on the evidence base, and that this is something as public health practitioners and health communicators and risk communicators, I think that we need to be very clear with people about. That there's a role sometimes for uncertainty, and that can be uncomfortable. And in this case, screening behavior seems not to have changed. If it had, what would we do about that? Again, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Shared decision-making can be a useful model for mammography and other decisions with conflicting or lacking guidelines and evidence. Thank you.